So today I'm going to be talking about the very last chapter in the book called The Essential Ernest Holmes. I don't know if you've ever read through that, Mary Rose, but it's the best of the best of Ernest Holmes. And the last chapter, which we're doing in October, because we're saving the chapter on Christ, which would normally be this month, for December, we're on something called the Banquet Hall of Heaven. And what this chapter focuses on is the great Sermon by the Sea that was given by Holmes back at the end of the Asilomar retreat in 1959. And Connie's been to Asilomar. Have you been to Asilomar?
Yeah. And my mother used to go every year.
She did. So she would have heard Ernest Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she might have been there to hear this.
She might have been. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Got the Kleenex here for myself. Connie's described this setting for me a little bit, the room that he talked in, and I've seen pictures of Monterey, California, and the Asilomar retreat area, and it's really beautiful. At some point in my life, I would like to go at least once. And I can imagine that if you go off to Asilomar for a week, you can love anybody for a week, and you feel enlightened, you feel really opened, and you feel like everything in life is possible. And then you go back to your everyday life, but the fact is that we teach that all of life evolves, and that you don't stay in one place ever. From day to day, we're continually evolving and growing. And so that week spent at Asilomar, it's kind of like when I was in college, I went to a conservatory instead of a regular four-year college. And in the summertime, I would go to a place called Meadowmount, which was it was like boot camp for string players, and we were required to practice 5 hours a day, and it would be monitored. They'd walk up and down the halls and make sure you were actually practicing, and then you could practice more after that if you wanted, and then you had string quartet practices, and then concerts at night, and. But, you know, the reason I'm bringing it up and making it analogous to Asilomar is that experience would carry me for months. You know, I would work on the fundamentals, my scales, my arpeggios, whatever, for so long that my body was in really great shape in terms of performance, and I didn't have to practice as hard when I went back to school in the fall. So you can imagine going to Asilomar is a little analogous to that, because you're there for a week, and I'm not too sure what the program of the day would have been then, but normally they have talks, they have yoga classes, they have times for meditation, and you come away from that feeling just incredible. And so I think the purpose of all faith, though, is, or retreat, is that we walk away and we bring that into our everyday lives. And just a week at Asilomar would change anybody for the rest of their life. So one of the things that we do gather from going to a retreat is things like an appreciation of one another. It's truly a setting where you see people at their best and not freaking out as a rule as they deal with their everyday life. And so we can love and appreciate each other. We have, every month we hand out an affirmation, which is something we're doing this year. And the October affirmation says that everything that lives proclaims the glory of God. Every person who exists manifests the life of God. There is one spirit in which I live, one mind by which I think, one body of which I am a part, and one light that lights my pathway. I am part of the evolution of human destiny. I am part of the unfoldment of the divine intelligence in human affairs. And that's a really awesome. Mm-hmm. That's so awesome. And I can imagine that after a week spent in Asilomar, I would probably feel that way I would probably leap out of bed and just feel like I had this incredible mission in my life. I just, you know, the more I talk about it, the more I'm thinking, why don't I go to Asilomar?
Why don't we all go?
Why don't we all go? Yes. Right, but that's one of the benefits that you get. And at the end of this week, I'm setting the stage for you a little bit. Ernest Holmes would get up and talk. And the last talk he gave focused on 12 qualities that he was talking about looking for in mankind. And I'm going to read each of these 12. Bear with me. And I'll comment on each of them. Because Holmes didn't talk with notes a lot of the time. Not all of it totally made sense to me. And I've been meditating on each of these 12 qualities. And you may have something you want to add to it as I read along. But these 12 qualities are probably the most quoted parts of religious science that you find in literature. It's hard not to cry. The first one is, find me one person who is for something and against nothing, who's redeemed enough not to condemn others out of the burden of his soul, and I'll find another Savior, another Jesus, an exalted human being. And the part that's quoted so often is, one person who is for something and against nothing. And, you know, as I was trying to picture what that person would look like, this person would be embracing all of his life, and he would not be complaining about it. He would accept every day as it comes, as a gift. Number two, find me a person who no longer has any fear of the universe or of God or of man or of anything else, and you will have brought to me someone in whose presence we may sit, and fear shall vanish as clouds before the sunlight. To me, there's something about a person who has absolutely no fear. I feel like it's like walking from a stuffy room into the outdoors when the wind is fresh and the sun is bright. It feels like you walk into a situation, if you're in the presence of a person like that who can handle whatever situation may come to him. And we tend to gravitate towards people who are calm and centered. And so that, to me, that's a person without fear. Number three, find me someone who has redeemed his own soul, and he shall become my redeemer. Now, I had a little problem with this one because, as a classically trained musician, I would hear or perform a lot of music about the redeemer, and that usually meant Jesus. And I was trying to figure what does that really mean? And so I thought about, in AA, one of the steps is to make amends wherever possible. And to me, a person who has redeemed his own soul is somebody who has taken the time to done that self-inventory and has attempted to make amends wherever possible. And so that he's a person who's not carrying the weight of any guilt of what he may have done to others. As a parent, that's really important. Number four, find me someone who has given all that he has in love without morbidity, and I will have found the lover of my soul. Is not this true, and why? Because he will have revealed to me the nature of God and proved to me the possibility of all human souls. And I just thought about, I thought of a few things. First of all, I thought about Jesus and the breaking of the bread and the distribution of the fish to the masses. You know, he took very little, but it was what he had at the time, and he made it multiply across a large group of people. It could be, I know that when I'm in the presence of a person who's very generous, I feel my heart opening. Mm-hmm. I feel really responsive to that person, and I love it when a person gives to me with no attachment or expectation of something in return. And I love it when I can do that too, when I can give to somebody and not expect anything back. And I love to see the look of pleasure on their face when I give to them. Number five is, Find me one person who can get his own littleness out of the way, and he shall reveal to me the immeasurable magnitude of the universe in which I live. And, you know, to me, thoughts that we have that may make us seem little don't really serve us. And I really started getting into that this morning because I had a laundry list of things that I needed to get done. And normally I'd be sitting there, you know, with too little time to get everything done, beating myself up. And then I thought to myself, well, no. He's talking about not belittling, and I do that really well sometimes, to try to get too much done in too little time, and then I feel pressured. And so I think it's really important to remember that it all gets done eventually, and I can relax, and so my laundry wasn't hung out this morning. Okay, well, I'll throw it in the dryer later on. Yes, ma'am.
Is that kind of like go with the flow?
Yes. But don't get on your case when things don't go exactly the way you planned it, because something better might come up. Number six is, find me one person who knows how to talk to God really, and I shall walk with him through the woods, and everything that seems inanimate will respond. The leaves of the trees will clap their hands. The grass will grow soft under him. And I've had many walks with Connie out in the woods, and it's been like that often. You know, magical things happen. Animals appear. We see incredible things like, you know, just leaves forming a pattern in the water in the fall, you know, becoming a mosaic of beauty. But there's something about being with a person who is that comfortable with themselves, and somebody that obviously is connected with Source, to be around them in nature or at any experience, you know, things just happen as though by magic. Number seven, find me one person who communes with cause and effect, and in the evening star will sing to him and the darkness will turn to light. Through him, as the woman who touched the hem of the garment of Christ was healed, shall I be healed of all loneliness forever. And, you know, I thought about that one for a while, and I thought that what I got from that was that being responsible for my own life allows others to live their own lives as well. Number eight is, find me someone who's no longer sad, whose memory has been redeemed from avidity, and I shall hear laughter. And this, I think, is pretty obvious. Happy people are attractive, they're fun to be with, and also people that are not dragging around unhappiness from their past are easier to be around. I'm thinking about this poor woman I knew at a church who, every time I talked to her, she'd mention her husband had left her over 20 years ago. And I thought, you know, I try not to be around her a whole lot.
She was one of my greatest teachers, too.
Yes.
When my husband died, she said to me, "You're so lucky that he died instead of divorced you." I thought that was the sensitive thing for that.
Then nine is, finally, someone whose song is really celestial, because it is the outburst of the cosmic urge to sing, and I shall hear the music of the spheres. And a long time ago I had heard David Gordon here playing the piano, and he always seemed to have an endless supply of music without any music in front of him. And I asked him one time, you know, what was he playing? And he said that there really only is one song. And that's the song we just keep playing over and over again. And I think that each one of us has a passion and a calling, and that we hear something in our heads. You know, maybe it's a design for something we want to landscape. Maybe it's something I want to knit. Maybe it's music to be composed. But we all have that inside of us that wants to get out and kind of leads us forward. It's the sort of thing, at least for me, it makes me want to get out of bed in the morning, because I know I have something that I've just got to do. And we're not always clear on exactly where we're going to head with it, but we just know that there's something we've got to get out, and that one song that we have to keep on playing over and over and over again in endless variety. And then number 10 is, find me one person who no longer doubts, no longer wavers, but not one with a proclamation of superiority says, look at me, I've arrived, I will not listen to that. Only that which reveals me to myself can be a message to me. Only that which gives me back myself can save me. Only that which leads me to the God within myself can reveal God. And how can you feel when you're accosted by somebody on the street? And I used to, when I was in college, I used to go out and try to get people into this Buddhist group. And I quickly discovered that I was working on my own rejection case, because as soon as people would see you coming, they head the other way. And I quickly learned that anybody that's getting up and trying to convert people or bring them into some kind of, like a church environment, normally is somebody that's going to be pushing people away. Number 11, find me a person who's so completely divorced from all arrogance, and you will have discovered for me an open pathway to the kingdom of God here and now. And this is the kind of person who can listen with an open heart and with acceptance. And lastly, find me somebody who's detached his emotional and psychological ego from the real self, without having to deny the place it plays in the scheme of things, and without slaying any part of himself, because the transcendence is here also. And I will have discovered the ineffable in this individual and a direct pathway for the communion of my own soul.
Could you read that one again, Jamie?
Find me somebody who has detached his emotional and psychological ego from the real self, without having to deny the place it plays in the scheme of things, without slaying any part of himself, because the transcendence is there also. And I will have discovered the ineffable in this individual on a direct pathway for the communion of my own soul. And, you know, what I thought to myself is, as I was meditating on this particular quality, was people I've encountered that have adopted rules, especially rules about the way women should and shouldn't be, because being a woman, I react to those the most strongly. And I often find that any group that has a set of rules like that is not going to be one that I can't adopt a set of rules like that for my own life. I have my own need for expression and my own path in life. And so I often think of the Dalai Lama, who is, I don't see him out there telling people what to do or how to live their lives, but he is truly an example. He laughs a lot, and yet he's got the weight of the world on him, or he could have the weight of the world on him, but he's one of the most approachable, lovable human beings that I have ever encountered. Not that I'm talking to him on a regular basis, but I try not to miss opportunities to see him on YouTube or, to just see him giggle is a wonderful thing. He's a truly remarkable person. So, in summary, that person is, they're kind, they're self-aware, they're generous, they're secure in their faith, and they're truly connected. And a lot of those qualities that I just read made their way into the Global Heart Vision. So these 12 qualities, having been rewritten and distilled, are what make the foundation of what our faith, what our movement is heading towards today. And so you might ask, well, where am I going to find that person? It almost sounds like an impossible job description. And of course, there's only one place to find that particular person, and that's within ourselves, each one of us. And those 12 qualities are there. And then he says, find 1,000 people who know that, and the world would no longer be famished. How important it is that each one of us, in his simple way, shall live from God to God, with God, in God, and to each other. That is why we are here, and we are taking back with us, I trust, a vision and an inspiration, something beyond hope and a longing that the living spirit shall through us walk anew into its own creation and a new glory come with a new dawn. And I mean, my heart melts every time I hear those words and I think about it, because that was written in, or spoken back in 1959, many, many years later. It's over 50 years later. We have many thousands of people that are moving towards that. The movement of religious science itself has evolved a great deal since 1959, and we are, in the Global Heart Vision, we've embodied a lot of that philosophy. And I know that when I applied for graduate school at the Institute for Conflict Analysis, that was uppermost in my mind, that we learn to live in a world where we see each other as friend, no matter where in the world we may be, that we are able to look at another person and we're able to see the qualities in that person that we can love and we can cherish, that we feel open with, that we feel we can give to, that we feel that... we don't have to make a religion out of giving to other people, but that we can give to other people simply because we have so much, we live so abundantly. And of course, right after that talk, in the next decade, two decades, you begin to see the beginnings of that outpicturing. We had many of us who grew up in the 60s and 70s, that might be all of us. We had anti-war rallies. We had pro-peace rallies. We had really, really sometimes violent movement towards civil rights for all of us. We had a widespread use of hallucinogenic drugs, which, in my opinion, are simply an attempt to experience God consciousness in a pill. So we've made a lot of progress towards the global vision, and I expect that we'll continue to do that as well. It's easier to see today, looking back 51 years and looking back and seeing that, oh my goodness, the world really has changed. A lot of the things that he talks about don't seem so radical now, but back then, back during the Cold War, it was, it was perhaps a little radical. And I think that one of the hallmarks of truly, really good visionary material is that it continues to hold its value long after the words are spoken. So then I wanted to close with one of the things he said during his sermon. He said, after a week like the one of the Sillamar, sometimes one might feel like there might not be another year. And he said, it's of complete indifference to me and I feel fine. Such an event is merely the climax of events in anybody's life, and it is to be looked forward to, not with dread or fear or apprehension, but as the next great adventure, and one that we should be all be very happy and glad to experience. And of course, as we all know, he was dead within less than a year. So I think that was probably pretty prophetic, but he left us with this really powerful and enduring vision. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's hear it for the 60s.